Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello there, and it's nice to be down in the studio because upstairs the new Media Network office looks as though a bomb just hit it. Papers and tapes everywhere after our move from another part of the Radio Netherlands building. The mail this week, though, has brought with it about 20 excellent suggestions for the programme, each with newspaper articles and background, so thanks very much for your support. We're doing further research on those items now. And thanks, too, for all the other letters to this programme and other English-language transmissions. We're simply delighted. The reception reports on the special transmitter tests continue to flow in. The double transmitter QSL cards come back from the printers next week. And it seems we're not the only people doing transmitter tests to the USA. Next month, Radio Japan will try single sideband broadcasts to the western half of North America. The exact plan has not yet been announced, but according to a telex from Radio Japan, they'll be using a power of 30 kilowatts. Well, our first topic today concerns the programme magazine Voices, which has also generated some correspondence to both us and other international broadcasters who've given it publicity. Back in 1980, the magazine appeared with a refreshing format, with shortwave programme information on a day-to-day basis aimed at the international English-speaking listener, and various subscription offers were made. Now Media Network has learned yesterday that Voices Incorporated is being wound up. So we contacted Patrick Humphreys, one of the people behind the project, and I asked him first of all, what's gone wrong?
Well, immediately what's happening is that I'm leaving the company and that it's folding up. Basically, what went wrong is that it no longer runs on promises. The promises of advertisements that didn't turn up, the promises of help from stations that didn't come, and the promises that I've made to the people who put Voices together that one day they would get paid. No one has yet, and not me either. And no one obviously now is going to.
Now, some people would say that you've used their subscription money to play with a project that's now fallen through, your little baby.
Well, yes, we have used their subscription money. We've also, as I say, made very large losses ourselves. And the people that have paid for subscriptions and have still some magazines to receive, well, they're not going to get the magazines and they're not going to get their money back, I'm afraid. It's not much consolation, but at this end, we've lost a great deal more.
How much?
Well, I've had to take a second mortgage on my house. The most that any subscribers lost, assuming they didn't get any magazines at all, was $12, and I've lost $10,000.
And what's the basic reason for the lack of advertising for Voices?
These days, magazines are made by advertising. No big company advertises before they're sure of the market, and very few companies still are. Shortwave is still very little trusted. We thought that if we worked on it very hard for 3 years, we would have a magazine to show that would produce more faith in shortwave and international radio in general, so that then we would be able to go to major international advertisers outside the field of just equipment manufacturers and show them that it was really working. Well, we thought that we'd done that with the last issue, but we were still too small fry as far as they were concerned, and we couldn't get the capital that we needed behind us in order to continue the magazine and try and build it up even bigger.
What about people who sent money in after the last issue, for example, the beginning of this year? Did you keep the money or what?
Well, as soon as it became clear in March this year that we might not be able to continue, we closed all our post office box numbers, and anyone that managed to get a check sent through to us got it sent back automatically. So after that point, no one's money was taken anyway.
Now, in what way is your concept of a program magazine different from something like Review of International Broadcasting or the International Listening Guide, some of which are making money, others being non-profit?
Our idea was twofold. It was to be a journalistic effort that was put together by people that knew something about the field. This doesn't necessarily mean they wouldn't be listeners, but unlike Review of International Broadcasting, we would try and concentrate much more on a journalistic effort with people writing in information, writing in, let's say, from strength that they had themselves. In other words, people that knew a lot about international broadcasting. We also didn't want to as openly accept information, either on programs or frequencies, from the radio stations as most shortwave magazines do. We wanted to check it, vet it for ourselves, and produce a condensed guide that would actually tell people what was available and give them some idea of what was good and what was not.
There was talk back in July that you had a cooperation agreement going with a Finnish company in order to try and get the magazine off the ground. Did that fail as well?
We talked with quite a few companies. Everyone that we talked with said that yes, we did seem to have a magazine that journalistically was viable and that seemed to serve an existing market. But in terms of paid subscriptions, we never got beyond 5,000 of people that were actually on our list and had paid their subscription to receive the magazine regularly. And this was just not enough to be able to convince the hard-minded businessmen that run large publishing houses that it was a viable market. I mean, we are still obviously open to suggestions, and although Voices Corporation is now being folded up, the expertise that we've gathered here and the lists of people and the contributors that we've had would still be available if a project like this could be worked out again in the future. But we haven't managed to find a publishing house with enough capital behind them and enough interest in promoting something like this.
Aren't the shortwave receiver manufacturers interested at all?
They are indeed, but there are not enough, in our experience, of shortwave receiver manufacturers who are able to distribute on wide enough markets, in other words, international, multinational companies, to be able to rely on their advertising alone. We need to have much more general international advertising.
Would you warn someone off who's planning a similar project in the future?
On the contrary, I hope that similar projects will come up in the future, and I think that probably Western industrial world comes out of its present depression, things will look better for a similar magazine. And I'd also be absolutely delighted to correspond directly with anyone who was interested in making such a magazine and give them all the details about what we did and what I think we went wrong, where I think we went wrong, and who they could cooperate with to make the magazine work.
Well, what of the future yourself, then?
I'm not now financially in a position to try and do anything of the sort myself. I'm now, as I said, up to my ears in debt because of Voices. I'd be continuing, I think, with Radio Finland, although I'm very much aware that this has knocked a very great hole in, my reputation in the international radio world.
Well, the Voices story is not an isolated case. The September bulletin of the World DX Club in Britain says people who've sent money to a group calling themselves Radio News International, something we didn't mention here on Media Network, but which has received publicity elsewhere on the airwaves, it seems subscribers here have not received anything. It's wise to bear in mind, then, that there are few multinationals operating in the shortwave business, and profit margins are in many cases very slim. Which leaves us, Media Network, in a dilemma. Do you wait until a magazine, equipment supplier, or organisation has been running for 5 years before you think it's safe to publicise it? Or do you risk that the venture will fail with the result that people will lose money? Well, because shortwave information is hard to find, we do broadcast material in good faith, like our colleagues. But remember, if we spent our time and budget checking the financial stability of everyone with something to sell, or based everything on rumours from competitors, this programme would never go on the air. Well now, let's move to Africa and this month's Media View, our look at broadcasting in southern Africa. Today it's the turn of Botswana, which, believe it or not, has a recent link with Edinburgh in Scotland. Here's Richard Jinby.
Botswana's first radio station was located not on Botswana soil, but inside South Africa, at the Imperial Reserve near Mafeking, the then seat of administration of the Bechuanaland Protectorate. The station was a small 1 kilowatt shortwave transmitter operating under the call letters of ZNB. The first station inside Botswana began life in a disused prison cell in Lubazi, 75 kilometres south of the capital Gaborone. It was a 400-watt shortwave transmitter, which started out in 1963 as ZNE-55, later to become ZND. On the 1st of February 1964, radio station ZNB in Mafeking closed down. A month later, ZND moved from Lubazi to Gaborone, where it began broadcasting from a caravan outside the post office building, this time announcing itself as Radio Bechuanaland. By 1967, a year after independence, the station had been renamed Radio Botswana, and they had three transmitters, one each on medium wave, shortwave, and FM.
This is Radio Botswana broadcasting from Gaborone.
Today, the station has two 10-kilowatt shortwave transmitters, a 50-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter, two 5-kilowatt FM transmitters, one at Gaborone, the other at Salibe-Pikwe, and there is also shared airtime over a 50-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter at Salibe-Pikwe. Radio Botswana is a non-commercial government station on the air for 13 and a half hours daily, Thursdays to Sundays adding an extra 2.5 hours. National news bulletins in Setswana and English are broadcast four times a day weekdays, and each has a distinctive introductory theme.
This is Radio Botswana broadcasting from Gaborone.
At the time of Rhodesian UDI in 1965, the British government, in voicing its displeasure, installed a BBC relay station on the outskirts of Botswana's northern commercial centre, Francistown. The Salisbury government retaliated by jamming transmissions, and the station was eventually closed 3 years later. Now Botswana has another international radio station on its soil, the Voice of America, which opened a medium-wave relay station at Salibe-Pikwe, a modern mining town in northeastern Botswana, in September 1981.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing off.
Our VOA English language evening broadcasts to Africa may be heard on frequencies in the 13, 16, 19, 25, and 31-meter band shortwave. And also in southern Africa, 1730 to 22 hours GMT on 621 kilohertz medium wave.
This VOA station relays Washington's African service in English, mornings and evenings. Daytime relays of Radio Botswana began in February 1982.
And now that link with Scotland. At the recent Edinburgh Radio Festival at the end of August, Douglas Muggeridge, managing director of BBC's external services, gave an address on the challenges of operating an international broadcasting station amidst political pressure. It's the price of working in a true democracy, he said, and he rejected outright the recent Polish government accusations that the BBC was broadcasting subversive propaganda. But in the discussion which followed, several of those present pointed out that the BBC had, on one occasion at least, succumbed to political pressure from the British Foreign Office with the operation of the transmitter in Botswana. Muggeridge agreed that this was one occasion when the BBC had slipped up, but said, and I quote, "The station was not broadcasting propaganda, but it was broadcasting a specific programme to a specific audience. There was an enormous row, in fact, and it came off the air very quickly." Talking of the BBC, Monday, October the 4th, we'll see the introduction of an expanded version of the Waveguide programme on World Service. Joining me on the line from London is the programme's editor, Andrew Piper. So, Andrew, is the plan to make it in a form of the old World Radio Club?
No, because World Radio Club, we felt, had had its run, and Waveguide is, in fact, starts from another premise altogether. It's not aimed at the Xers, not aimed at the specialists, but for the general listener, and we're going to continue that as our philosophy, aiming at the general World Service listener and helping him or her to hear World Service better.
When you say a general listener, do you have a typical listener in mind?
I think a person who's not terribly sophisticated with short waves, who doesn't know his way around the set, but would like to. That sort of listener. And I think we're thinking not just of the third world, but European listeners too. We get a lot of people writing in from Europe who have problems listening to shortwave, and we like to help them too.
Now, with the expansion to 10 minutes, does that mean the emphasis is changing from a programme to help people tune into the BBC towards a programme with information about other radio stations?
I think we're going to start off in the way we're doing it now, namely to base ourselves on helping World Service listeners to get a better service. But obviously we're going to increase, with 10 minutes, we're going to increase the feature-type material within the programme. Obviously we're going to help the listener to listen to other radio stations as well, but this isn't really our aim. It's just a spin-off, I suppose.
OK, what are the features you're going to introduce?
Well, we are hoping to have a regular report from the BBC's monitoring service at Caversham, possibly once a month. And we're going to do more of the sort of thing we've been doing already, but we haven't really had time to develop, and that is receiver reviews, things like that. In fact, things like that Media Network does already, but that sort of thing. We've got a few things up our sleeve, which I won't mention.
You regard yourself as competition now, do you?
Not at all, no. I think we're all in the business together, and we serve different sorts of audience. We, I think, are still looking at the World Service audience. We're helping that particular section of the listenership, if you like.
Yes, I'd agree. When does the new version go out?
We've got four placings. First placing is on Monday at 09:15. This is Greenwich Mean Time, of course. Tuesday, 0100. Wednesday, 0430. And Wednesday, 17:35.
Andrew Piper. The BBC is also starting a special five-part series on Monday, October the 4th, called The First 50 Years, looking at the history of World Service. It goes out on Mondays at 03:15 and 14:15, Thursdays at 10:15, and on Friday at 21:45 UTC, and it should be an informative reflection. Each episode is 15 minutes.
Media Network. In the opinion of some critics, the most boring, inaccurate, disorganized, sloppy communications magazine there is. Which is why they listen every week to make sure.
Well, shortwave conditions have been playing up yet again these past few days, which leads one to wonder whether the propagation forecasters can ever get anything right. In fact, the ability to predict conditions in advance is quite difficult, since you first have to build a mathematical model to represent what's happening in nature and use the maths to predict what nature will do next. The most important factor to consider is the sunspot cycle, which has a bearing on the ionosphere and thus shortwave receiving conditions. The more natural factors you consider, the more complex your model. Dr. David Meisel is a professor of astronomy at the State University College at Geneseo, New York State, USA. And he pointed out to me just how reliable our predictions of solar and propagational activity really are.
There was a conference in Boulder in 1979 where this question was addressed, and the consensus that came out of that conference was the following. We probably can predict 1 year ahead within, say, 20 to 30%. Again, this is a very great average of all the activity. Now, there is probably a way now of predicting solar flares visually, if you can look at them either with a satellite or from ground-based observations, within a couple of hours. Now, this is usually, for military purposes, quite satisfactory. For planning purposes, it's a different matter. I've been experimenting with a system which seems to work anywhere between 60 and 80% accuracy over a 27-day cycle. that it's very experimental at this point, and it depends on where you are in the world, how well it works. The other problem is, of course, predicting seasonal data ahead. Now you must remember that almost all of the prediction methods involve one step or two steps ahead. So when you say 1 to 2 steps ahead, if you want to know 1 year in advance, then you have to go back on data that's an average over a whole year and then run that forward. If you want 3 months in advance, then you must do seasonally likewise. So if your data time base is taken at once every 3 months, then the best you can do is to do 3 months ahead. When it comes to what the sun is doing presently, the really big question at this point is, can you predict what the next sunspot cycle is going to be like? I think that this conference at Boulder in 1979 addressed this question reasonably well. It appears that the next cycle, based on the best that we know now, begins showing up on the sun during the previous one. So that if you go on the basis of the magnetic activity of this cycle having been predicted by the magnetic activity of the last cycle, it looks like one can predict one full solar cycle ahead. If the trouble we're having now with the shortwave bands is any harbinger, it means that the next solar cycle may be as high as this one.
So maybe goodbye to the so-called 11-year sunspot cycle. Well, just over a year ago, David Meisel took over a private propagation service, then run by George Jacobs, formerly of the Voice of America. The scheme is called MailerProp.
If you're a person who, for your job or for setting up schedules or contest times, it's important to know what it's going to do in 2 weeks, then we think we have at least the best publicly available service for prediction available. On the other hand, if all you want to know is to plan your frequencies 3 months in advance, then there are other sources of this information.
Is the data going to be much use to people living in Europe or, say, the Pacific or only North America?
Well, at the present time, because of the way George had it set up using U.S. models for the ionosphere, we've been pretty well constrained to paths starting in the U.S. and going to other countries. I hope within a month or a year to be able to make available some predictions of using models that I've developed for almost any place in the world. We've had these models kind of under wraps, and they've been very experimental for scientific purposes. RCI has been cooperating with us on it. ORF in Austria have been doing some work with us on it. And it looks as if the models that we've developed now are reliable enough that I think we can go public on them and hopefully have some predictions, say, for Central Europe to the same zones that we do now for the U.S.
Right. We have things certainly in Europe called weather satellites and all sorts of complicated computer predictions for weather, and they always seem to be, well, not always, but they're usually quite wrong. Now, what about the MailerProp? Is that accurate? Can you claim accuracy?
Well, what we try to claim is that the accuracy is as high as the data will permit you to extract. When the sun begins to do funny things, the statistics go bad, so that your prediction accuracy can drop down to 30%, 40%. One of the outcomes of the Boulder meeting was that no matter what you do, the state of the art at this point is probably anywhere from a 15 to 30% error, no matter how sophisticated the methodology. So we think when we hit 75 to 80%, we're doing very, very well. There are times, like in June, for example, when the sun looked like it was falling apart, where things dropped down to about 40%. And, of course, I was very unhappy, and I'm sure the subscribers were too. But at least at this point, it's no more my judgment per se. It's whatever the numbers coming out of the computer say. So I don't have to be personally responsible for that. Everybody else will be having the same trouble if they use the same numbers.
And if you'd like more information about the service, you can write to this address, MailerProp, 54 Westview Crescent, Geneseo, New York, zip code 14454, USA. That's MailerProp, 54 Westview Crescent, Geneseo, that's G-E-N-E-S-E-O, New York, 14454, USA. You'll also find that address on page 14 of the new Radio Netherlands booklist, available free of charge from us here at Media Network. Inquiries, by the way, should enclose 2 international reply coupons if you're writing to the US address. Now for a look at the Asian media scene, let's cross to Victor Gunatilaka, who's been active with a tape recorder.
Well, Jonathan, things really got exciting late last month when Radio Seychelles was taken over by rebel soldiers. This station, operating on 1368 kHz in the medium wave band, usually provides fair reception in most of South Asia. The moment I heard about the rebellion, I tuned to 1368 kHz, and from then on, it was real excitement. Although I didn't understand what the rebels were saying in Seychellwa, I really caught the high-pitched excitement by their frequent extortions like these. Finally, the rebellion was crushed and President Albert René went on the air to address the nation.
Aux heures du soir, on cause avec autres avec beaucoup de chagrin de mon équerre. Hier grand matin, un groupe soldat qui prend quand l'armée Unionville. Ça qui un beau matin.
Well, everything is calm in the Seychelles now, but I still love to listen to this station for its exotic, beautiful music from the Seychelles. The station fades in around 1445 UTC and English news is heard at 1500, which is 8:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time. FIBA Seychelles, which goes off the air the moment there is a crisis in the country, came back on the air a few days later. Incidentally, FIBA Seychelles has a very fine South Asian news coverage at 15 hours UTC on 15325 and 11895. 11895 kHz is a new frequency, while 15325 has been used for a number of years.
Asian Media News Roundup.
Last month, I announced the emergence of All India Radio Aizawl. Jose Jacob in India says the station has installed, in a record time of 1 month, a 10 kilowatt transmitter. Alok Das Gupta, who compiled the following schedule for us, also confirms this information. The station uses 5050 kilohertz in the 60 meter band and 7295 kilohertz in the 49 meter band. From midnight 30 to 02 hours and 12:30 to 16:30, they use 5050, and on Saturdays it's extended up to 17:40. 7295 kHz is used from 02:15 to 03:45, 8 hours to 10 hours, and 11:30 to 12:15 UTC. The music you will hear from this station is quite unique for a subcontinental station, and certainly that tag of subcontinental music may not be the way to describe this type of music. Moving on further east, Isao Ugusa says that Singapore is to set up a Khmer language radio service to support the Cambodian resistance forces.
This is Radio Singapore. Here's the news read by George Favaggio.
According to New Straits Times, it suggests to be a Radio Singapore operation. Perhaps that standby 10 kilowatt transmitter they have been testing on various frequencies and the 10 kilowatts on 5010 may come alive with Campuchian. The target date was September, so watch out all the DXers. Now for a giant leap across to Canada and their time signal station CHU with its 3 kilowatt transmitter on 14670. After that feature on CHU in a recent media network program, I was motivated to look for it and heard it at 2235 UTC on 14670, giving time signal stations in both French and English. Down in South America, radio station HCJB comes in regularly around 17:30, going well past 19 hours with its gospel religious programming. The frequency 21477.5. This, by the way, is almost identical to Radio Netherlands' frequency at 14:30 in the 13-meter band.
Thanks, Victor. And with that, we have to go back to the sort-out upstairs. If you know how to salvage radio stickers that have been burned onto a window by the sun, drop us a line. We'd need you. We're out next week with a special feature on utility stations. In the meantime, from me, Jonathan Marks, and the rest of the team, cheers till then.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network program. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.